Hello, I'm Anna Lutfi, and this is The Verdict. Brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law, King's College London, The Verdict is a radical experiment in legal podcasting. We're bringing law closer to home in a world where legislation, regulation, and the courts seem increasingly remote to the general public. Back in July 2021, I spoke to Adam Wagner. He is one of the UK's most well-known human rights and public lawyers. He's acted in the Supreme Court and at the European Court of Human Rights and at all other levels, widely regarded for his extensive expertise in public law, human rights, prison law, immigration and asylum, inquests, medical law, mental health law, and actions against the police. He's acted in 6 public inquiries, and currently he is specialist advisor to the Joint Committee on Human Rights COVID-19 inquiry. He's a much sought after legal commentator on social media, TV and radio, and he's also a podcaster himself, host of the Better Human podcast. Adam and I came together to discuss the effect COVID has had on our civil liberties and our human rights, and some of the significant cases he has worked on recently, including his work on the impact of the pandemic on our enshrined right to protest. Adam, thanks so much for joining The Verdict. We have at the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London, we have a strong emphasis on human rights law. We've got professionals who are working in really hot topics such as modern slavery and big tech and digital human rights. So it's a real pleasure to speak to someone like yourself who is a very well-known human rights barrister. But you have quite an eclectic portfolio. You act in public inquiries, you founded human rights charities, the Human Rights Blog. You're the host of podcasts such as the Better Human podcast. Would you be able to comment on what you think links all of these different areas of your practice and your work?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure. I guess the link is human rights. And I always, when I came into the bar, I didn't want to be a sort of backroom lawyer. I wanted to be a public advocate for human rights. That was the approach that I wanted to take. I didn't have it all planned. But when social media came along, which was in the sort of very early years of my practice, I immediately dived in, set up the Human Rights Blog while I was a pupil, and started using Twitter pretty early, in the general scheme of lawyers using Twitter. And I've always really enjoyed combining court work with issues-based advocacy and generally being a sort of, I think someone once described me as the traveling salesman for human rights, which is, I'm actually pretty happy with that description. I'll go anywhere and talk to anyone about the benefits of the Human Rights Act, of human rights generally, the ideas and the principles behind it.
Well, I should have said, you appear regularly on mainstream media and television, radio as a legal commentator. So that's another aspect of your work. And I just wonder, as I'm listening to you talking about being a sort of human rights salesman, there's something about human rights that non-legal professionals or lay people can get their heads around, because people talk about their rights and they talk about their human rights, even if they have no interest in law whatsoever. In a way, they wouldn't discuss other areas of the law. Do you have a take on why human rights? I mean, I suppose it's obvious. It interests us all because we are all human. But is there a way in which people do feel they know their rights independently of knowing the law?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the idea of individual rights is a very magnetic one. One of the reasons it's been so successful, or I suppose we can have the argument whether it really has been successful, the reason it's caught on as an idea in lots of parts of the world is it fills a gap in our society which isn't filled by normal politics. It isn't filled by just sort of culture. It's something where people have their own rights or their rights as a community, and they can, and it's quite a simple list of rights. If you use the Universal Declaration or the European Convention, is even more simple. And it's something which we all own, we all should be able to own, and a child should be able to talk about their right to freedom of expression or their right to freedom of religion in as visceral a way as an expert lawyer. So I think that it's got that attractiveness and ease of understanding. And I think the other thing in the UK context, one of something that was pretty obvious to me when I joined the bar. So I became a barrister. I was called to the bar in 2007, so just under 15 years ago. That the Human Rights Act, which had been in operation for 7 years at that time, was changing the way people thought about law, and it was changing the way judges thought about law. It was bringing in a different kind of law to our system, which hadn't really been there before. And I think one of the reasons why people are so interested in, you know, the kinds of social media things that I do, and you know, that they've been all been fairly popular, is that there was this big gap opening up between what the public understood to be the law and what really was the law and how interesting all this new stuff was. So there was a real gap for people to who knew about it to go in there and explain it.
That's an amazing segue to what I wanted to discuss, actually. One of the things we're trying to do on these podcasts is to talk about issues that aren't dominated wholly by COVID. But having said that, I do want to talk about COVID because I think more than perhaps any other lawyer in the country, you have made COVID a human rights issue or a set of issues. And you've discussed on social media and in publications that you've authored all sorts of aspects of COVID that people might not normally consider, because obviously, on the one hand, it's a straightforward public health emergency with restrictions that accompany that. But on the other hand, there's this whole relationship with how law is made that has been thrown up for national debate. And you've talked about the distinction between law and guidance. And I remember when the first lockdown happened, you talking about that distinction and tweeting about it. And I was really pleased to see someone trying to navigate that, because even as a legally trained person myself, it's very, very, very difficult to know what technically we were allowed and not allowed to do. So I think that speaks to your sort of commentary on what human rights are and why people hold human rights dearly, because they feel they ought to know. They ought to know what they can do and what they should be able to do. So could you say something a little bit about your role as specialist advisor to the Joint Committee on Human Rights COVID-19 inquiry, what that involves, and then a little bit about the distinction between the law and the guidance as you see it and how it's evolved and what it means for us?
So when COVID came along, you know, I was as flawed as everyone else was, and it was an extraordinary, and it remains an extraordinary time, but especially in those early months. But I really felt in those early months, and particularly from the 26th of March, when the first set of lockdown regulations arrived, that there was a special role in this crisis for lawyers and for human rights lawyers. And I don't say that we had, you know, a more special role or even as special role as the doctors treating COVID patients or what have you. But all of a sudden, we're in this extraordinary situation of regulations, makes them sound less than they are. They're, you know, criminal laws being brought in by ministerial fiat that were changing the basic way we could interact with society, you know, making gathering with more than one person illegal, making it illegal to go and worship in a church, making it illegal to be in our own homes with a person that we were in a relationship with that didn't live with us. These were, you know, way beyond, I think, any kind of restrictions we'd ever had in law, and certainly anything done by regulation. And that just raised the most profound issues. And I felt like, you know, straight away, having done 10 years of this kind of work, but, you know, this mixture, this strange mixture of my work of legal work, human rights law kind of commentary, and being out there in public, being that, sort of, you know, trying to explain the law, you know, to the extent that I set up a charity, as you said in the introduction, called Rights Info, it's now called Each Other, whose purpose, for certainly the first few years, was to explain human rights law in an interesting and accessible way. But I felt like all of those skills could be used to navigate this web of, and it's increasing maze of regulations, and also highlight some of the issues around them, which to me and a few other commentators were pretty obvious. You know, the lack of parliamentary scrutiny, the use of regulations in this way, the constant changing of the regulations to make it impossible for people, the police, anybody to understand, and also the, as you say, the, this very difficult mixing and matching of guidance and law. So I just sort of started doing that, and I got a text from Harriet Harman, who's the chair of the Joint Committee on Human Rights, asking me, you know, this is right in the first few days, I think, after those regulations, saying, you know, would you get in touch with me? We might be doing an inquiry. I don't know how long it was, but within not very long, I was specialist advisor to this inquiry. And this was an inquiry which was running live. And there were five reports in this inquiry over the course of a year. It was running live whilst this crisis was happening. It was a really amazing privilege to do it. I've never done that kind of work before. As in, I've acted in many public inquiries, but only after the event, never during the event. So it was quite a task because we weren't just commentating. We were in a way shaping what was going on. It's a bit like sort of the Heisenberg principle. You can't write a report from the Joint Committee on Human Rights during a crisis, and it doesn't just sit there and, you know, as a piece of history. It's there to try and influence policy going forward, whether on contact tracing or the the fixed penalty notices or the way the regulations were structured, all that kind of stuff. We wrote a bill to try and prevent this sort of power data grab through the NHS contact tracing app, which actually never happened. So it really was, as a lawyer, it was really one of the highlights of my career. It was really extraordinary, an amazing team. And I think the work itself was good work that will stand the test of time. Many of the things we highlighted in those early days became the big problems, such as guidance and law, such as, you know, the many, many issues around, you know, and the way that these laws were being created.
Yeah, as you're describing your experience, the word that came to my mind was extraordinary, and then you said it's the most extraordinary experience. It is extraordinary. It's extraordinary because the legal situation is extraordinary, and then to be placed in such a position where one is able to at least try to shape the direction of travel. And I found it quite moving the way you put the whole situation together in the article that you wrote for Prospect in March earlier this year, which I'll put a link to with this podcast. You combine two registers for me as a reader. Well, on the one hand, you're trying to technically identify the problems. The distinction between law and guidance is one, the uses and abuses of secondary legislation to give ministerial powers far more scope than they perhaps should normally have in a democracy without that parliamentary scrutiny. You track that brilliantly, but you also have a less lawyery tone, a more philosophical tone, where you ask questions such as, how quickly does freedom die? And for me, what was quite powerful was the question, how quickly can you resurrect freedom? And you further say, we may never recover our standing as free citizens. I mean, and again, that word extraordinary is an extraordinary read, and I really recommend it to listeners, because you somehow do identify a major existential problem with our democracy, which is that we can't guarantee that what we give away we will receive back. And I just suppose my question is, what did you mean by how quickly can you resurrect freedom? And do you think that we can resurrect it post-COVID?
Yeah, I mean, thank you. And thank you for the kind comments about the article. It was a real labour of love, that article. You know, they were trying to put everything together that I had, my concerns, in a way which was kind of credible, but also a little bit polemical, which is always I try and sit on that line, which isn't always easy, and particularly with COVID, it's not particularly easy. I think that one thing that COVID has demonstrated is that during a national crisis, freedoms can be taken away, and there's no obvious way to get them back, except unless they're given back. And that is obvious from the fact that, you know, a lot of lawyers, you know, I think Tom Hickman QC in particular has been a big influence on me, and we've worked a lot together on particular cases, actually, check judicial review challenges. But he, you know, highlighted very early on this issue about the regulations being by, you know, stretching the boundaries of emergency laws. First, fair enough, the first few weeks, but what about the, you know, we're a year and a half later, and there's still regulations being made by fiat. This, you know, it's been completely normalised, and Parliament really, and I think that the expression I used in the Prospects article is that Parliament have become so supine, they've almost, they've practically prorogued themselves. And I think that's, that really is the case, that they've, you know, we thought that there was this big Supreme Court battle about Parliament being prorogued, but, you know, what use have they been for the past year and a half? In everything has been waved through. There's been no, you know, there's been a bit of jumping up and down, but not to any real effect. And I think, you know, I'll give you a few examples of case. So in my sort of really bizarre year and a half, I've been doing, spinning all these plates at the same time and trying to attack this issue from different perspectives, whether through the Joint Committee and the work there, whether through social media and writing articles and just saying stuff publicly on TV and wherever I can. But also I've been involved in a lot of cases, so a lot of legal challenges to aspects of the regulations. And two areas that spring to mind are, first of all, the right to protest, and second of all, the hotel quarantine system. So in relation to the right to protest, I've been acting quite a number of protest cases around people who have been prevented from protesting during the pandemic, because the Metropolitan Police in particular, but not exclusively, have treated protest as illegal. And I think it's pretty clear. So the main case I've been acting in is for the Reclaim These Streets organisers. So the vigil, which was meant to take place after the death of Sara Everard, after the killing of Sara Everard. And that became a very big national, national crunch point in this, over these, all of these rules. And it really felt to me, I was very depressed by the way that went, because what effectively happened is we went to court to get try and get an interim order saying that the Met Police's policy was unlawful. And we got a kind of fudgy judgment, which said, absolutely, if the Met Police have a policy of treating all protests as unlawful, that would be a breach of Article 11 of the Convention, the right to freedom of assembly and association. But he also said, the judge, well, the police have turned up today and said that's not their policy. So, you know, that's as long as that seems all sorted then. But the police didn't change their approach and effectively continue treating my client's organisation of this vigil as unlawful. And therefore, it couldn't happen in the form that they wanted. They couldn't go in the end. And it kind of, you know, I feel it really sort of squashed what should have been one of the major national and perhaps international movements of this year, you know, along with Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion. There was a third element, which is the, you know, the protection of women, to be, you know, the movement for women to be safe walking down the street at night. Yeah. That's what Reclaim These Streets, and the original Reclaim the Streets was about. And I feel like it was quashed. And the reason it was quashed was because the police wouldn't let it happen. And I mean, that case is actually going through the courts now. In fact, today we've just been granted permission to proceed. And because this, that's not publicly known, but because I know this podcast is going out not tomorrow, it will be known quite soon. But it's going to be a really important case, because it's about, you know, what was the right approach to these regulations during the pandemic. But I think the reason I find it depressing was because it showed to me that there was pretty much nothing we could do. I put together, basically, I spoke to the women who were organizing this on a Thursday morning. By Thursday afternoon, we had a legal team together of really the best people we could possibly have for this kind of case. We had a case, we crowdfunded nearly £40,000 in about an hour to run the case. So everything went in the way we could, you know, the best way possible. And we got into court and we got more or less what we wanted, but it didn't matter. It didn't make a difference. It didn't solve the problem. And I think that, for me, shows the limit of the law, the real hard limit of the law. You know, and the other cases, I've been dealing with lots of cases about hotel quarantine. So this is a system where a detention, she's never been admitted by the government that it's detention, but it obviously is detention, of over 40,000 people, including lots of children, in airport hotels run by an Australian private security firm with really poor conditions, really dodgy, you know, provision of healthcare. That's, you know, all of the basic things you need when you're detaining people for 10 days at a time in the most horrific, in certain circumstances, situations. And it was all done by these emergency regulations. It's never been properly scrutinized by Parliament. The Joint Committee on Human Rights has never looked at it, you know, and I'm not criticizing them, but because wasn't primary legislation, it takes a big, you know, for them to deal with it, they have to trigger their own inquiry, you know. So the courts haven't properly looked at it. I've taken a few cases, injunctions to the courts, get people out successfully. In all the cases I've dealt with, have been successful, actually. I've probably dealt with 10 of them. We've managed to get people out of this hotel quarantine in all 10 cases because, you know, the government doesn't really have a leg to stand on because the system's kind of broken. We've succeeded in getting the government this week to say that it will waive or reduce fees for people who can't afford it, because lots of them are literally stuck abroad because they can't afford £1,750 or more to pay for hotel quarantine. And they were abroad not because they're on a skiing holiday, but because their mother died and they had to go and see them or whatever it is. And they can't get back. And all of these are just the most unbelievable issues, but they are being shoved to the back of a million other issues that are going on. And I think they are, to come back to the original question, they are examples of freedoms being taken away. And it's not obvious to me who is going to restore them.
Wow. Well, thank you for that very detailed response, which covers a lot of the territory that I was going to raise. And
it's a very long response, but no, as a barrister,
it's what we need to hear. I mean, these are about lessons that you've learned about how our legal system works or doesn't work through the casework and the practical issues that you've confronted with real people, real lives. It's not good enough to have endless constitutional discussions about the rule of law and freedom and democracy if we ignore, you know, what you've just outlined in terms of the detention of citizens that haven't committed crimes, or the real very pressing needs of people to be able to visit family members in other countries. And I'm really glad that, you know, we can give you a platform to just air some of these stories. I have a personal sort of investment in this question when you talk about the limits of law, because I studied legal history in Central Europe. I lived in Budapest in Hungary for 15 years. And as a scholar of that region and its history, particularly in relation to the Soviet period, I became quite fascinated by how relationships between citizens break down and how the legal system is replaced by something like an unwritten contract where citizens automatically give unlimited powers to the state. And that also breeds distrust between people, and there's a culture of informing and spying and surveillance, and this is well documented. It's not new. But what is new is that in countries like Britain, there is, I think, a tendency to assume that we're above all that. And I know that during the first lockdown, there were concerns about a culture of spying when there were police portals set up for people to report their neighbours for breaches of COVID, restrictions and so on. And that did get some press coverage. I wonder if you, on a more positive note, do you think that experiment in getting citizens to spy on each other and report on each other, do you think that was a short-lived experiment? Do you think that there is something about the UK where we do have safeguards, whether they're legal, cultural or political, that can prevent us from absolute abuse of power? Or does what you see on the ground indicate a dangerous direction of travel that we should perhaps really be talking about all the time?
Yeah, no, I mean, those are tough questions. I think they're really important questions. It's very hard to know, and particularly when you're involved in the human rights field, where you're constantly facing the worst aspects of society from all different directions. The worst abuses, you know, the end of the wedge, whether it's the thin end or the thick end of the wedge, I'm not sure. It's easy to oversteer, to use an expression that I think Keir Starmer's fond of using, because you think, oh well, if I'm seeing that, then you know that this is just demonstrates that everything's going to, you know, going to rack and ruin. And on the other hand, you have what human rights are all about, which is, I think, what Pierre-Henri Tijan, one of the founders of the human rights, modern human rights movement, called an early warning system. And it's kind of, you know, it's a bit like the it's a bit like the bells that you put on strings outside your house. You know, if there's somebody outside the house, you kind of want to know. And this is this early warning system. It makes sense to me, and it's always been something that's been really important to me. The reason why I think human rights are important in the UK, and not just in countries, you know, broken societies, countries which are not democracies, countries where the rulers are entirely corrupt, is that it's this understanding which comes from directly from the horse's mouth, which is the people who lived through the death of liberalism in previously liberal states in Europe during the Second World War, particularly just before the Second World War. And as you say, and we're living through communism and the sort of, you know, the abuses there. They knew exactly what to look for. They knew the early warning signs because they'd seen them and they hadn't heeded them, or they'd heeded them, but no one had listened. So I think it's arrogant and foolish and ahistorical to think that if you allow people to be spied on, if you allow the police to get involved in political protest and to prevent the protest that they want, if you allow politicians to give very large state contracts to their friends and family, it's just foolish and naive to think that that isn't a thin end of the wedge, because you know, corruption breeds corruption. And we just, it's so obvious. And to think that, I agree with the point you made towards the end of the question, which is that in Britain, we have a rich and pretty ancient tradition of liberty, which has prevented certain kinds of ideologies taking root. And that's great. And, you know, good for us, bully us, as we'd say. But the kind of early warning system shouldn't be the only thing we're worried about. As in, we shouldn't be looking to, you know, the fascists are here as our litmus test for whether things have gone wrong. We should be looking for there are elements of corruption or abuse or fascism or whatever you want to call it in our society that we need to nip in the bud. We need to remember why these things are bad. They're not just bad because they leave bad places, they're bad in and of themselves. And we need to, you know, take hard decisions to root them out, even though, I think one of the points I've been making throughout this crisis is these things are much harder in a crisis because people really, you know, and there's lots of research out there about when people feel threatened, they are much more, you know, they'll support the leader, and it doesn't matter as long as the leader is strong. It doesn't really matter what the leader is up to. They'll turn a blind eye because security is more important in those situations to many people than, you know, liberal values. So it's really difficult in a crisis, and therefore you have to be, from the human rights perspective, doing human rights during a crisis like this is being a pain, being a gadfly, being a someone who is going to get in the face of the leaders who may, with all the good intentions of the world, be doing the wrong thing. So that's the challenge, and it is a huge challenge, and not one that I'm particularly assured has been done successfully, at least by me.
Well, you say that, but I think the fact that we can have this conversation where I'm speaking from a law school, and I know that you also teach human rights law, I believe, at Goldsmiths College.
Yeah.
So there is this bridge that you are straddling between the world of legal practice and also education. And maybe what you're saying is that there might need to be a kind of national project post-COVID, or following all of the changes that we've seen, the sort of systemic shifts within our political and legal system, a sort of re-education of the public program where we teach them the fundamentals again, what it means to be a democracy, what it means to have separation of powers, and how the legal system in this country has traditionally operated, and what are those warning signs that we could even perhaps turn COVID into a sort of learning curve that we benefit from rather than lose out. I mean, that would be a positive spin. And maybe the university...
I totally agree with that. Sorry to interrupt, but I was just saying I totally agree.
the university is perhaps that's something useful that universities could be doing. And if this conversation can sort of be part of that process, moving that conversation forward, so much the better. I've taken quite a bit of your time, and I'm very grateful for your time. I know particularly today you've in and out of court, and so I want to wrap up, but before we go, just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about other areas of law that you work in, other than sort of directly COVID related human rights cases. You've been involved with some quite high profile cases over the last year and a half that don't have to do with COVID, and any other projects that you're working on in relation to your existing organizations, or new things coming up that we could flag with the podcast when we broadcast, so that people can find out more about what you're doing.
It's as you said at the beginning, I'm fortunate to have a very varied practice, although it's getting a bit less varied now as I'm focusing pretty hard on inquiries and human rights and public laws related work. One case that I was involved in just before the pandemic hit, or maybe it was going on actually during the pandemic, was the Harry Dunn litigation, which was really interesting case, remains an interesting case, about international law and the protection of people, ordinary people who are caught up in some diplomatic incidents. Harry Dunn was killed by a car driven by the wife of a US diplomat, although it turned out to be a bit murkier than that. And that was absolutely fascinating, and I've as a result of it, I've been involved in a few other similar kind of diplomatic immunity or diplomatic law type cases. I do a lot of inquiries. I may be involved in the COVID inquiry at some point, I don't know, but I've always enjoyed working in inquiries because they're just that bit different to normal bar work. You get to work in bigger teams, they're a bit more stable in terms of the amount of work you get, and they've got a sort of different structure to a litigation, which is a bit less urgent and a bit more like a sort of 9-to-5 job, which for self-employed peripatetic barristers can be quite a relief. In terms of projects, I've always got projects on the go. I'd really like to write a book at some point about all this crazy stuff that's happened in the past year and a half around law and COVID and human rights and all of that. I just need to get myself motivated enough to arrange for that to happen. And I carry on my podcast, the Better Human Podcast, which you all are welcome to listen to. The charity that I chair and that I set up called Each Other is going from strength to strength. It's just opened up an office in Glasgow, as well as to join the office in London, which is great because Scotland is a very human rights positive place and a great place to be if you're a human rights organisation, unlike London, which is quite human rights negative. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much, Adam. I'll put links to as much of that as I can and as you want me to. It's been a real pleasure, and thank you for all the amazing work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by the Dixon Poon School of Law at King's College London. Subscribe to The Verdict wherever you listen to your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at KCL_law, and follow the Dixon Poon School of Law on LinkedIn.